I'm going to skip number two. We'll come back. By the way, the Sanskrit is, we got to say number three because you can't understand number three until you do number four. Okay? But this is the normal order. Say Yeshi Chukku. Yeshi Chukku. Yeshi means wisdom. Chö means Dharma. Ku is Kaya. This is the wisdom body of the Buddha. Okay? The wisdom body of the Buddha. It is the Buddha's omniscience. The fact that the Buddha, at any particular instant, can see every existing thing in the universe that ever was, is now, or ever will be. Ultimate reality or deceptive reality, all at once. No problem. The Buddha can perceive all of those things at one moment. Okay. That makes the Buddha omniscient. Okay. The Buddha is not omnipotent, by the way. Okay. I mean, just as a point, the Buddha cannot change your suffering with a wave of his hand. And he said that. Okay. He did not make the world. You made the world. He can't take away your suffering by doing anything special. If he could, he would have. What is he, a sadist? You know, if he could have removed your suffering with some kind of, you know, woo-woo, you know, would have done it. Cannot do it. Is not omnipotent. Doesn't have the power to do that. But is omniscient. Does know all things. Okay. That brings us to this body. Lo-nyiku. That's the emptiness of the other three bodies. Okay? Lo means essence body. This is the essence body. It is the emptiness of the other three bodies. What's the emptiness of the first body? The Manakaya. What's the emptiness of the body that comes to planet Earth? What's the emptiness of the Dalai Lama's body? It is anything but not a projection. I'll say it again. It is anything but not a projection. That is emptiness. That's the emptiness of the Dalai Lama's body. To state it positively, to state its dependent origination, the Dalai Lama is forced by his past karma to perceive himself as having a nirmanakaya. Those arms and legs which you and I see in a certain way, and his enemies see in a different way, and that he sees in a totally different way, those parts, he is forced to project onto that Buddha's body. His experience of his own body is, oh shucks, I'm being forced to see this as a Buddha's body by my past karma. Okay, his enemies see this very evil man who's trying to split up things, you know, and his disciples see a guy who looks like a regular human being, and they say he's something special, and he certainly does act special, but right now that's all we can see. Okay, that's the emptiness of the Dalai Lama's body. Okay, that's part of his essence body. Okay, the fact that he is anything but not a projection of his own is part of his body number three. Okay? That's the emptiness of the Dalai Lama's body, of his physical body. It's not a projection. It's not a projection. That's the emptiness of his body. And that is his body number three, part of it. Okay? Excuse me? By the way, there's a big difference between the Dharmakaya and the Jnana Dharmakaya. The Jnana Dharmakaya is his wisdom, is his knowledge. The Dharmakaya involves body number three and four together. What they call Dharmakaya is body number three and four taken as one. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And then they call Rupakaya is body number one and two taken together. Okay, and that's why you come up with two sometimes. What's the emptiness of the Buddha's omniscience? And then we'll stop. Okay. What's the emptiness of the Buddha's omniscience? We only got half the essence body so far. We got the emptiness of his physical body. He has the karma to be forced to see this data as a deity's body. You know, he's being forced to see that. That's the dependent origination of his body. The emptiness of his body is his body ain't anything other than that. What about his mind? That's really cool. What about his mind? What's the emptiness of his mind? It's a projection. Onto what? Onto the parts of the mind. What part? Well, let's take the mental functions which accompany all consciousness. He has feeling. He's able to discriminate between things. He's able to direct his mind to certain objects. He's able to focus on something. These are all mental functions. All of those mental functions and the main mind taken as a whole, the Dalai Lama is forced to see as a knowledge body, as a wisdom body. He's forced to see that as a wisdom body. Very interesting. You and I got the same parts of our mind. We have attention, we have concentration, we have discrimination, we have sensation. We all have those. Bugs have those. But he's being forced to see it as what? Omniscience. And that's the only way you get to omniscience. It's very interesting. If you want to get to omniscience, you better collect the karmic seeds that are going to force you to see your own parts of your own mind as omniscient. It's very interesting. You don't get there any other way. What did you think? You thought that some guy was going to do surgery? You know, was it something external? It's very interesting. What is happening is a shift in your own perceptions. The gray stuff is the same. The object, the basis of that imputation is the same. You are being forced to interpret it in a different way. You're the guy sitting next to me at work instead of me. It's very interesting. A shift is occurring in your projection, and you are passing from ignorance to all-knowingness. That's how you get to be a Buddha. It's cool. Okay. Yeah.
So, are you saying that my emptiness of the Dalai Lama's body is different than the emptiness of the Dalai Lama's body from his own side?
Absolutely. No. I'd say your projection onto the Dalai Lama's body is totally different from... Do you think he's getting old to himself? Is Avalokiteshvara getting bald? You know? To Avalokiteshvara. To Avalokiteshvara.
Yeah.
You know. Is this, you know, is it getting wrinkles? Come on.
But yesterday you said that emptiness was equal and the same for all objects.
Oh, the emptiness, that's why I said the projection is different. The emptiness is totally the same. You know, if you understand his emptiness and he understands his emptiness, it's totally the same. Now, can you really perceive his total emptiness the way he perceives it? Not yet. But if you ever did at any point, it would be absolutely the same as the way he perceives it. Because it's only the fact that he ain't anything other than a projection. It's double negative. Emptiness is a double negative. And that's why, by the way, that emptiness could never be anything positive. Emptiness is a lack of something. Emptiness is the absence of something. If you get somebody stand up and say, emptiness is a little yellow, and it's a sort of glowing, and it comes in down from the sky, you know, and impossible. It's an absence of something. It's the mere absence of something. The fact that there's no two-headed elephant interrupting our talk today is similar to emptiness in that sense. It's the fact that something that which was never there ain't there. The gotcha that was never there isn't there. That's emptiness. The gotcha that could never have existed anyway is not there. That's emptiness. The Dalai Lama's body and mind are anything but not something projected. If you want to say it positively, which is its dependent origination and not its emptiness, it is only his projection. And it could never be anything else. That's his emptiness. It's cool. He's being forced to see his own mind as omniscient. So what's body number three? It's just the fact that the other three bodies aren't anything else. Okay? The other three bodies are not anything else except a projection onto certain data, okay, which is being forced upon the Buddha by 74,000, 75,000, 76,000, and 77,000 countless eons of doing good stuff. All right. Where did you think that the good deeds stayed? Where did you think before? How are they going to make him into a Buddha? Did they come back from Pluto on this big orbit and hit him and suddenly he's a Buddha? How do you think you get to be a Buddha? Is it something outside? Where does karma stay in the meantime? And how does it ripen? It's in your mind. Mm-hmm. All right, we'll stop there. See you at 3, right? Oh, 2 questions on your homework. Oh, boy, I would have gotten in trouble. This is how I stress the class out without looking like it. Explain why the Buddha said that the marks of a Buddha are deceptive, yet also true. They're deceptive, yet also true. They are fake, and they are true. And that's the what deceptive reality means. Kunzop Denpa means fake reality. Fake truth. False truth. The word means false truth. In what way are those marks on a Buddha's body false? Because the Buddha said both. The Buddha said they're both. I better look at the... yeah. Okay. Yeah, they're false in that it looks like they exist independent of the Buddha's projections, but in reality they're not. Okay, they're false in that sense. The Buddha in the Diamond Sutra says, Subhuti, those marks are false. They're not real. What did he mean? He meant they're artificial in the sense of being your creation. They are artificial. Same thing. When I say projection and they say name, Mingde Shaktam, which means only in name, is interpreted by the highest schools in scripture as meaning Sopetaktam, meaning a projection of the mind. It's the same thing. It's the same process. It's sometimes called imputing or labeling, and sometimes it's called projecting. Same thing. The name in this case does not refer to a sound or letters, which is what normally Ming refers to. It refers to a concept, a conceptualization. Okay. It's very tricky. Okay. That's the fakeness of the Buddhist marks. What's the reality of the Buddhist marks? They were never any other way. They're empty. That is real. The fact that they were never anything but a projection is real. That's true. The fact that they were never anything other than a projection, that's real. The fact that they don't seem to be a projection but are a projection is their deceptive nature. Mm-hmm. They don't look like a projection. Mm-hmm. All right, last question. It says, explain why the Buddha says twice that the Buddha's body has no marks on it. Okay. In that sutra, at the end of your reading, you'll see the Buddha says, the body of a Buddha has no marks on it, no marks at all. And poor Chonedapa Shirdi has got to try to figure it out. The first time he says it, he's talking mainly about the first two bodies, which are what? Yeah, it's the two physical bodies, which do have marks on them. So when he says, the first time he says the bodies of the Buddha have no marks on them, he's talking mainly about the first two bodies. Okay? Do they have marks on them? Huh? It's a Buddha back there. Do the first two bodies of the Buddha have any marks on them?
Not in the sense you just talked about.
Good. Not self-existently. Not gotcha-ishly. Okay? If you go try to find a mark on a Buddha that didn't come from your projection on certain data on his skin, you ain't never going to find a mark. Okay? In that sense, they're impossible. I'll repeat. If you go out and try to find a self-existent mark on the Buddha, you'll never find one. In that sense, those marks do not exist. Okay? You won't be able to find them. Yeah?
Do these marks, are they perceived by those that are in the paradise?
Yeah. By the Bodhisattvas.
By the Bodhisattvas.
Yeah.
Is it their projection?
There ain't nothing which is not a projection. Yeah. One more point, and then I'll answer a question. The second time he says the bodies have no marks, he's referring to, what do you guess?
The second two bodies.
The second two bodies, but mostly number four, because number three, what? Number three covers the whole question. Number three is the emptiness, but he's talking about three and four. Bodies number three and four. And actually, I'm sorry, mainly he's talking about number three. The scripture says mainly he's talking about number three. Why? When he says the second time, it's very short. In the scripture, he just says, no marks. No marks at all. The Buddha never repeats himself without reason. Never. It's a big point in scripture, you know. The Buddha never says something twice unless there's a point to it. Okay. He said Subhuti was hard of hearing. The first time he says it, he's meaning there's no self-existent marks on the physical body. The second time he says it, he means, hey, come on, body number three is the fact that there is no self-existent mark. Don't you get it? It means repeat. The second time he says no marks, he means body number three is the fact that he has no self-existent marks. Body number three is his lack of self-existent marks. I don't think so, because he's talking physical, but I won't get into it. Okay, one question. Yes.
It sounds like the first discipline, so maybe if you reach enlightenment, but at the same time, destroying the conflict, blowing up the conflict so that you don't become attached to them and realize it or eventually.
Say again. And say loud.
It sounds as if the scripture is building up a series of concepts to enable you to reach enlightenment, while at the same time self-destructing those concepts so you don't become attached to them and realize it or resent it.
This gets into the question of, you know, could you be attached improperly to the body of a Buddha? I mean, what she said that they're building up the concepts or the methods of reaching enlightenment, but at the same time they're trying to tear them down in a sense that they're trying to make them not an object of your attachment. They're trying to make them not be something that you would be attached to. So that you're constantly thinking about the emptiness of those ideas. It's true in a sense, yeah. We definitely saw emptiness in the sense of when you're angry at something. You know, you understand now how to be patient with somebody by using the concept of emptiness. And I won't answer her question, but I'll give you another question, and that'll be something to cook about. How do you use it when you're talking about desire? Okay. Obviously, emptiness is useful when you're talking about a boss who's screaming at you, and you don't want to perpetuate that screaming boss. But how do you use it when you're about to commit adultery? You know, you are attracted to someone else's spouse. You're just about to commit adultery. How would perceiving emptiness at that moment stop you? You know, how does it relate to desire?
Understanding nature of karma.
I'll just leave it like that. Think about it. You know, do you get the pleasure that you're about to get from that spouse by going after that spouse? Is that the way to have that sensation of pleasure? Is that where it came from? Did it come about through your efforts to sneak out and get to this place and meet her somewhere? Is that how you got the pleasure from her? It came from a special kind of karma in the past. Getting pleasure of that nature from a person in that situation comes from a certain kind of karma. It's called being faithful to your wife or your husband. Very interesting. You know, if you're going to have some pleasure like that, It's going to come because you kept yourself away from sexual misconduct in the past. You were very pure. You were very good. And because of that, you're able to project pleasure of that type. If you didn't want to have that pleasure anymore, if you wanted to make sure that you never had that pleasure again, what would be the best way to assure it? Commit adultery. It's very interesting. It works with desire as well. So now, philosophical desire that you're attached to the concept, maybe you can play with it in the same way. You know? Okay. I'm sorry that we went on. I'll try not to do that. Okay. We'll just go straight to some prayer. Yeah. After all these heavy classes, I thought you might like a little lighter class. Gives you a chance to rest your brain. Me too. There's a point in the sutra next where, you know, the Buddha's gone through all this heavy stuff, and the Buddha looks at him and says, you know, in the days of the last 500, he says, in the days of the last 500, is there going to be anyone around who still understands all this stuff? You know, will there be anybody who can still figure out all these things that you've been talking about? Because it seems pretty, very difficult, very over everyone's head. And, you know, if people nowadays can just barely understand it, what about in the future when the Dharma is starting to decline in the world? Subhuti says, I can't imagine that there would be anyone around who could still understand what you're talking about, you know. And we'll talk about the answer later, okay? I'll put you in suspense, all right? And then Kamala Shila in particular begins to speculate about what does the last 500 mean. And then he's checked all these sutras and he came up with what it means, and it relates to the decline of the Dharma in the world. You know, how is it, how will it happen that the Dharma dies out in this world? And then Chonin Drakpa Shedrup, in his commentary to the Abhidharma Kosha, he also discusses that. So I thought you might be interested about the discussions about the end of the Dharma in the world. I mean, the Buddha had predicted that his own teachings would die out in this planet. And particularly Vasubandhu at the end of the Abhidharma Kosha in the last chapter, he talks about the end of the Dharma in the world. To understand how the Dharma will end, you need the two kinds of Dharma. So we'll start out with that. Say Lungicha, Topicha. Lungicha, Topicha. Okay. Lung means literally, Lung means, it's related to the word for wind, and it means the spoken word, the word. Okay, the Dharma in the sense of the word. Okay. Like when someone gives a lung means an oral transmission. We're going to have an oral transmission next Sunday. My Lama received the oral transmission for the diamond cutter from one of his great lamas, Drupa Kangma, who is related to, I believe he also taught Pabongka Rinpoche. And then we're going to get, I'm going to pass it on to you guys. That's where you get someone just gets up and reads out the whole sutra, and you just get this oral blessing from the lineage of that. Okay. Then you can pass it on to other Westerners, which is cool. Tsopa means realization. Tsopa means the Dharma in the sense of realizations in people's minds. Okay. So the first thing is the Dharma in the sense of the physical manifestations of Dharma, the books and the teachings, the verbal teachings. And then Tsopa is the Dharma in the sense of it being existing in people's minds. Mm-hmm. I'll give you examples of each. First is what we call the three baskets of scripture. Okay. All Buddhist scripture can be divided into three baskets. It's what you hear, it's called Tripitaka. In American say Tripitaka. And in Sanskrit. But these are the three baskets. The first one is called Abhidharma. By the way, the basket of Abhidharma is not the same as the topic called Abhidharma. Okay? Like the Abhidharma Kosha is teaching a whole system of philosophy that was followed in India by a school named Vaibhashika, and that's not what this means. This means a whole section of the Buddhist teachings called Abhidharma. Then there's the Sutra Pitaka. Obviously, all the teachings of the Buddha that are not secret are called sutras. But this refers to a specific group of the teachings which are also called sutras. So don't get confused between general sutra and sutra basket. Mm-hmm. And then the third one is Vinaya. So when you talk about the physical Dharma in the world, you know, does the physical Dharma still exist? Do the teachings still exist in the world? You could start by saying, does the word still exist in the world? And then you would say, do these three baskets still exist in the world? Okay. How do you divide these three baskets? Okay. What's the difference between the three baskets? They're divided by their subject matter. Okay. Abhidharma is books that primarily talk about the training of wisdom. The subject of wisdom. Sutra in this case means the books that treat the second training, which is what? Meditation. And then Vinaya? Ethical life, yeah. Training on an ethical life. These three trainings build on each other. And we talked about it Friday night if you were there. In order to see emptiness, for example, your mind must, in order to see it directly, your mind must be at a certain level of concentration. And we talked about that. It actually corresponds to it's a certain cause for a birth in the form realm, actually. It's a cause for the first section of that and for the preliminary part of the first section of that. In other words, to see emptiness directly, your mind must be at a certain meditational level. That level is not even in this realm. At that point, your mind is not in the desire realm. Your body is still in the desire realm, but you're totally out of you're not aware of your body at that time. You're not aware of any of the objects of the senses. And your mind is in a totally different realm. It's in a Samden Dumbo. We call it the first concentration level. And as you come out of that, you have a physical sensation of descending from that. It's a physical sensation you would have of coming out of that afterwards. But in order to get to see emptiness directly, you must reach that level of meditation. You have to reach that level of meditation. It's only on that level that you can see emptiness. In order to reach that level of meditation, your heart has to be clean. Your life has to be clean. You have to be following an ethical life. It's impossible to reach this kind of mental quietude if you have anything major on your conscience. It's impossible. Can't do it. So these build on each other. That's why the three trainings are the three trainings. First you clean up your life. And I don't mean be perfect, because we can't be until much later. But major dirty things that you're doing, lying, stealing, hurting other people, those have to be cleaned up before your mind can reach a state of quietude. Based on that, you can reach that level of meditation. Based on that, you can see emptiness directly. So these three baskets, Abhidharma, Sutra, and Vinaya, are the word, the Dharma in the sense of the word. These three trainings are the Dharma in the sense of what? Realization. That is the Tokpe Chö. Okay? The Dharma has two parts. The books, and then actual realizations inside of people. The books divide into these three sections, and the realizations basically divide into three different types. Wisdom, meditation, and ethical life. Okay? Those are the Tokpe Chö. And at the very end of the Abhidharma Kosha, Vasubandhu, I mean, it almost makes you cry. I mean, he talks about these two divisions, and then he says, he starts to describe how they will die out in the world. Okay? Which one do you think dies out first? Huh? It's actually the realizations. Okay? People stop having realizations. The books are still there in the library on a CD-ROM somewhere. Okay? You know, the books are still around. They're collecting dust in some New York Public Library warehouse, not on 43rd Street. That's the Lungyucha. That's the death of the Dharma, the physical Dharma. The Buddhist books are being lost in the world, being destroyed, being lost. Nobody cares much. You know, they're being every day being lost, and nobody cares. They're just put away somewhere, and that's it. They die out second. This dies out first. You know, that people really understand the Dharma and are practicing it. That dies out first. What does it mean to keep the Dharma, or what does it mean for it to die out? Vasubandhu, he describes that also. The Tokpe Chö, the realizations in the hearts of people, obviously that dies out when people stop achieving these levels. When people stop achieving renunciation or bodhicitta or wisdom, then the Tokpe Chö is dying out. Lungi Chö, he says, is dying out when people can't explain it correctly anymore. Okay. To say that it's still being preserved in the world means that at least somebody's around who could explain it properly. Tokpe Chö still exists in the world if there's anyone around who still understands it, who's still reaching those levels through the practice of Dharma. Okay. Now, what's this deal about 500s or no 500s? When is it going to happen? Okay, when is the Dharma going to die out? Did it die out yet? I'm going to give you Chanadapa Shuddha. He gives a whole list of scriptures, okay? I'll give you a few of them. He checked a whole lot of sutras, and in his day there was a lot more information available. And he goes through. I'm going to give you a few of them. Say, Dode Kelsang? Dode Kelsang? Dode Kelsang says, by the way, most of these dates are dated from the passing of the Buddha. Okay, it's dated from the day that he reached his parinirvana. Okay, in this sutra, the Buddha says, "My teaching will stay in the world 500 years in its pure form." And then 1500 years in what we call a shadow form. It'll still be around. It won't be very serious. It won't be very strong. 500 years in its true form. Another 1500 years in sort of as a they call Sugyen means just an image of its former self, a shadow of its former self. Okay. And then those two things have disappeared in the world. The teachings are no longer being explained properly, and people are no longer reaching the major spiritual levels. Okay. That's one presentation. Say, Ningje? Pekka. Ningje? Pekka. Ningje means compassion. Pekka means the White Lotus Sutra. Okay, it's the White Lotus Sutra of compassion. Okay. In there it says 1500 years. to Dawa Ningbo?
Dawa
means moon. Ningbo means essence, the essence of the moon. The sutra of the essence of the moon. That sutra says 2,000 years.
So far with that note.
Let's go to the longer one. Sutra of the essence of the moon. Say Dorje Delba. Dorje Delba. Dorje is a lazy way to write Dorje Chopa. Okay. Sometimes they call it Dorje. Sometimes they just call it Che. The Mongolians call it Jodba. Jodba means commentary. This refers to Kamala Shila's commentary on this book, on the Diamond Cutter Sutra. Okay. Kamala Shila's commentary on the Diamond Cutter Sutra. He's a little more optimistic. I'll give you one more. You don't have to write the second part, but I just want you to see the direct quotation. Say, famo timegi do. Famo timegi do. Famo means what? Goddess, okay. Lady angel. She's right there. Time. I always heard about this quotation and I never found it. And maybe 6 months ago I found it. Choni Dapa Shedu quotes it. It says, Lo Ni Tong Ngabjana. Say, Lo Ni Tong Ngabjana. Dong Ma Chen. Ki Yul Du. Dabe Che. Dar. Lo means years. Ni Tong Ngabjia means 2,500 years. Na here means after. Okay. Dong means face. Marchen means a ruddy complexion. Tibetans call us Dong Marchen. It means Western people. Okay. People with a white complexion with ruddy cheeks or something. Okay. Dong Marchen Gi Yuldu. Yuldu means to their land. Dambe Che means the holy Dharma. Dar means it will spread. So I think that's really cool. that's a prediction in the sutra. It's still in the Kangya. The sutra is there. I always heard about this and I never really believe all this kind of thing, you know. But it's there. And it says that... that's the Buddha. Yeah. And he's saying after 2,500 years, the holy Dharma will spread to the land of the ruddy-faced people, which is what Tibetans call us. And then Kamala Shila goes into explaining why the Dharma will last for 5,000 years. And Choni Dapa Shedu, he shows why he believes that's correct. For many reasons, okay? But basically, I think the scenario we can count on is 2,500 years for it to get to the West and 2,500 years to be here. So... I mean, from what I understand of these scriptures, I see the Dharma lasting in the West for 2,500 years. And starting now. Starting right now. Okay. Starting in this 100-year period here. So I think it's pretty exciting. I'll show you why the Buddha says in the last 500. Okay. He doesn't say anything else. He doesn't explain himself. But there are other sutras which describe 10 periods of 500 years each, which makes 5,000. Okay. And by the way, there are other scriptures. I didn't go into all of them, but there are other scriptures that say 5,000 as well. The 10 periods go like this. In the first 500 years, lots of people are achieving arhat. Lots of people are getting to arhat. What's arhat? Reach nirvana. Okay? Reach nirvana. killed the enemy. Who's the enemy? Mental affliction, all right? Getting mad back at the boss, okay? That's the enemy. There will be, in the first 500 years following the passing of the Buddha, many people achieved that. So it was called the era of the Arhat, okay? Non-returner is a stage that you reach after you have wiped out a specific number of mental afflictions. Not all of them, but there are six versions of mental afflictions that if you wipe them out, you become a non-returner. It means you don't come back to where? The desire realm. Okay? We are in the desire realm. What other realms are there? In samsara there are two other realms, form realm, formless realm. You can't see them. You never will know if they exist really until you reach the path of seeing. After the path of seeing. But we are in the desire realm. And we are stuck here, and we were brought here by our mental afflictions. If you're in this realm, you're here because you have some mental affliction. Okay? If you're sitting on this platform and you are who you seem to be, which we never know, right? You're here because you have some kind of special mental affliction. Do you know what your specialty is? I know what mine is, you know. It's usually on the anger side or the desire side. You know, normally you have one or the other. If you're lucky, you have both, I guess. Definitely a good dose of ignorance. But if you're here, and if you're in this kind of body, this dead-end body, literally dead-end, then you got here by mental afflictions, and that's why you're here. And unless you've worked really hard in this life, you still have them. You still have the ones that got you here, by definition. Non-returner has been able to overcome six versions of those mental afflictions, specific intensities and versions of those mental afflictions. They will never come back to this particular realm. They will never be born in this realm again. They will never come back to the desire realm. Okay. Excuse me? Involuntarily. Okay. Well, there's a big debate whether anyone even comes back. Stream ender is what? It goes to Arya. Anyone who's seen emptiness directly, whether or not you're a bodhisattva, it doesn't matter. Whether or not you have true bodhicitta in your mind. Okay. If you've seen emptiness directly, you are an Arya. And you are a stream enterer.
But an Arhat, but stream
enterer. Arhat comes much later after Arya. Okay. Arhat means someone who has reached nirvana based on seeing emptiness directly many, many years before. Typically seven lifetimes before. Okay. Very typically.
What's higher, a non-returner or a stream enterer?
Non-returner is higher. You can't get rid of any kleshas until you see emptiness directly. Okay. And in between there's a once returner, but they don't get to have a kalpa. Okay. These three eras, these three groups of 500 years, 500 years each, right? These three are called the, what would you call it? The era of achievement. Dupe Liu. The era of achievement. Okay, that 1500 year period is set apart and called the era of achievement. The next three eras, I'll make it short. They are based on the three trainings that we just had. Which are what? That's short attention.
The era of
No, that's the book. How about the realization?
Wisdom.
Yeah, wisdom.
Meditation.
And ethical life. So during the next three divisions of 500 years each, many people are achieving the training of wisdom. Then after that, people can't achieve that anymore, so all they can get to is the training of meditation. And for the next 500 years, people can only get as far as, many people are only getting as far as the training of on ethic, ethical way of living. Okay, things are degenerating. Okay, yeah. You can master the three trainings before you even enter the first of the five paths. Okay? You can become very proficient in the three trainings before you even reach the first of the five paths. Okay? So this is referring to a very basic intellectual understanding of emptiness and karma, for example. Basic beyond, I mean, way beyond us. Okay? You know what I mean? To get to the first path is a great achievement. In this life, if you could really get fed up with this life, you would be at a great level. That would be a big achievement. Yeah, true renunciation.
So free training, we're only free training when they're practiced with renunciation.
Maybe you could say with feelings of renunciation, but not with the true total renunciation. There's many kinds of renunciation prior to the first path. For example, there's Buram Gishing Tabu Nyenjin, which means sugarcane renunciation, which means it feels like renunciation, but it's not very strong. Or sugarcane bodhicitta, for example, it's called that. There's another one called Nyenjin Pusa, which means goosebump renunciation. And that's when your mother dies or something in this life, seriously. And then for like 6 months, you really understand renunciation. And then it wears off. And you go back to living your old life, running after your career and houses and money and girlfriends and stuff like that. Okay. Number 7. 8. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. This is called the... What is it called? I made a mistake. Sorry. These three are called the era of results. Okay. I'm sorry. I made a mistake. These three are called the era of results. Okay. The first three, 1, 2, and 3. Then the next three are called the era of achievement. Okay. You could say era of practice. Next are the next three are eras when people are keeping the physical dharma. Okay, the lungi chu. So if you divide that into three, what would you get?
Abhidharma.
Sutra. Vinaya. Okay. During these three periods of 500 years, people are still teaching it correctly. It's still surviving in the world as far as the physical manifestations of the Dharma. It looks to me like Sopa Chura was pretty much endangered after this point. It looks like after 3,000 years, realizations are sort of rare, more rare. And then it begins to be just the physical Dharma being left in the world. People can teach it, but they haven't really realized it. Okay. Abhidharma, it's the three baskets. Many people are able to learn and pass on the information, but not the realizations. And that happens a lot, even in these days. Abhidharma, Sutra, and Vinaya. And the last of the 10, of the last of the 500 is called Taksam. Oh, by the way, these three together are called the era of Lung, which is what? The word, the physical Dharma, the book. Okay. Say Taksam.
Taksam.
Taksam means just a trace left. Just a trace left.
Mechanism whereby
resolve predicted on,
maybe just
through
clairvoyance, I don't know, but
why it was a mechanism whereby it degenerates. There's a Sabuti asked a good question. said, what makes it degenerate, basically? Yeah. Why doesn't it get better? Why does it get worse? Okay. And I'll talk about a Dharma teaching, okay? What's the emptiness of this Dharma teaching? What's the emptiness of this week going on? What's the emptiness of these 10 classes? Yeah, it's anything but not your vijay. Okay. All right. What's its dependent origination? Let's start. That's a little easier. It's your projection. Okay. This series of classes is your projection. There's this guy up there in a red suit, you know, and he's talking these noises. And you hear these noises. And different people sitting there have totally different reactions. Completely different reactions. You know, some people hear the holy dharma that's going to save their lives and make them reach nirvana. Some people find it intellectually interesting or not too much. And some people find it quite boring. That's the emptiness of this teaching going on. Okay? The data is the same. It's the same red suit, the same sounds coming out of the guy's mouth. But there's different people interpreting that data in different ways. Why? It's seeds in your own mind. Okay, your mind has certain karmic seeds. And you don't have a choice, frankly. I mean, if you're going to be born, you've got to be born. Because your seeds are ripening in such a way that they are forcing you to perceive this as boring. They're forcing you to perceive it that way. And if you're getting something out of it, or even as something of ultimate benefit, you have different kinds of seeds. Now, those seeds are very interesting. You know, the seed that would, this guy standing up there, or somebody like the Buddha gets up and says, you're emptiness. You're nothing. And then somebody perceives emptiness based on that. You know, the Buddha gets up and says something crazy. You don't exist. Bodhisattvas don't exist. Nobody reached nirvana. And the Buddha doesn't have any signs when he has signs on his body. You know, somebody gets up and says something crazy like that. And suddenly 500 people reach the perception of emptiness. I mean, this is what was happening in the Buddha's time. It was very common in the Buddha's time. Even his students, when they taught, they have lists, you know, 400 people reached the perception of emptiness, 300 got to this, 200 got to that. Just when they opened their mouths and said some simple thing like, nobody reaches nirvana. And they understood it immediately, what he was talking about. He understood the whole thing about projections and all that. So again, this teaching itself is a projection of you. The energy of that projection has to wear out. Okay, you have a certain karma in your mind stream that was planted there by your past life guy who worked his ass off to get you here, you know. I mean, we can all appreciate our past lives, especially me, you know. I mean, somebody was working really hard, you know. Somebody wasn't sleeping much, working hard, practicing like crazy, doing everything, guru yoga perfect, you know. And that's how we got to Vajrapani for this week. You know, that somebody did that for you. You should thank them, you know. because we're not collecting those kind of causes. Somebody was extraordinary. Somebody was really extraordinary. Out of a million people, you're here. Each person represents one in a million. And you're sitting here listening to this thing. How many karmas ripen in a split second? 64. Okay. It's called Jadzoke Ketik, okay? Jadzoke Ketik. There are 64 karmas ripening in that moment. For you, to maintain the picture of this guy standing up here, for one instant, for one finger snap, requires 64 discrete karmas going off. Okay. 64 different karmic events are ripening for your mind to maintain me talking about the Diamond Cutter Sutra for the time it takes to snap my fingers. So for you to maintain this image for a week is something extraordinary. I mean, I like to say, Korcho will appreciate the, wake up, he'll appreciate the bytes involved, okay? I mean, if you talk about it in terms of computers, the reason that computers can't show video very well yet is because, I don't know, it takes like 16 gigabytes to get somebody to move for an hour and a half or something. You know, to have that flow of the pictures for an hour and a half requires the computing power of all of Bell Laboratories labs computers 5 years ago or something. I mean, to keep it going requires an extraordinary amount of data. You know, for you just to hear me say one word requires a couple of hundred karmic events going off at the same time. For you to maintain me up here as a projection for the space of a week, You're using up an extraordinary amount of karma. You know, like all the electricity that California is generating this week, you know. I mean, it's some kind of extraordinary amount of karma that you're using up to hear something this holy, to hear the Diamond Sutra taught in these degenerate days for 1 week. To maintain that projection requires an intense amount of karma, an incredible amount of karma. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And it's something like the computing power it would take to keep a whole city, the image of a city working for a whole week or something. And it would be, you can't even imagine what it would take. That's how much karma you are using up to come here for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, that karma will be finished. You don't know if you have any more of it.
Okay.
You may or may not have any more of it. Some people will quit in the middle of the week. And that means they didn't have enough to maintain the whole week. Seriously. I like to be depressing because then people get... No, but if you take joy in it, you generate a lot of good karma. But basically, you're burning up. I mean, it'd be much better if you were out watching a movie for 10 days or at the beach. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of karma, but it's only like 1% of the karma that it takes to maintain this projection. The karmic seeds in your mind that are required to maintain this dude up there standing for 10 days is extraordinary. It's incredible. And it burns off very easily. You know, that's why you lose teachers. That's why teachers don't stay. That's why teachers go away. That's why teachers pass away. I mean, the karma of keeping them here is infinite. It's very, very difficult for any particular human being to maintain that much karma that long. Like the karma to have the Dalai Lama in the world is extraordinary, and it's wearing out. You know, he's getting old in our perception. Our projections are that he's getting old. So this is again another projection. The opportunity to have Dharma, the opportunity to hear it spoken, and especially about emptiness, that's what makes it impermanent. So Subhuti asked a good question. I wanted to talk about that. You know, that's why the Dharma will die in this world. It must die. It doesn't die independently. It doesn't die self-existently. It dies the only way it could die, which is what? Your projections stop. The power of your own karma to project that thing called Dharma in the world wears out. And if it wears out collectively, that's called... That's the end of the Dharma in the world. And it will happen. You can say that, but where do they come from? It's the same thing. It's all up... Yeah. But do you remember how the other Buddha appears? I mean, she studied. We had a class on the Abhidharma presentation of the universal cycles, where galaxies go into existence and out of existence and things like that. And as the world reaches its final days, in the Abhidharma Kosha, third chapter, end of the chapter, they describe how this world will be destroyed. And to put it simply. For example, there would be a fire that covers the whole world. Somebody has made some kind of weapon, and according to the Abhidharma, those weapons go off, and a fire covers the world, and almost everyone in the world dies. This is at the peak of a very degenerate age. The survivors, they say that some people are out camping like at Boulder Creek or something. And it's in the Abhidharma. End of the first time. And they go back to the cities where they used to live, and they're just destroyed. Everything's gone. The people are all dead. And they wander around the cities all depressed. And then sometimes they bump into each other. And they're just overjoyed to see another human being alive. And they have these... they get into small communities of survivors. And they start to discuss, why do you think... You know, what happened? What did we do wrong? And they say, oh, you know, we were crazy. We made these weapons to kill each other. We hated each other. We should stop all that kind of thing. So they start to practice the 10 virtues again. They start to respect life. They start to not steal things from each other. They decide that living that kind of life is what caused the world to be destroyed. Then they teach that to their children, and slowly the whole thing builds up again. At a certain point in their virtue, they have enough karma to see the coming of another Buddha in their world. And then that cycle is repeated 80 times. Long story, very long story. But that's basically the coming and going of a Buddha in the world is created by one thing, and that's the virtue of the beings on the planet. Whether or not you meet him, it's him or her, it's another thing. We'll take a break now. Come back at 4:30, okay? And then we'll finish. Okay, we'll start again. Now you get the punchline. How do we start out this class? Buddha, I'm sorry, so Buddha asked the Buddha a question. He said, in the days of the last 500, yeah, will anybody still understand all this stuff? Will there be anyone who still understands everything you've been talking about? And the answer of the Buddha is very sweet. He says, Sabuti, don't ask stupid questions. You shouldn't be asking questions like that. He says, there will come great bodhisattvas, even in those degenerate times, who truly have realized these things and who understand them. He says, don't worry. He says, even in the very degenerate times, there will come great bodhisattvas who understand the wording of it and understand the meaning of it and who have realized the meaning of it. He says, don't ask that question to me. He says, and then the Buddha starts to talk about those bodhisattvas. And he says, those bodhisattvas won't see any self. Those bodhisattvas won't see any person. Those bodhisattvas won't see any life. I'm going to change this person, sorry. We'll call it sentient being. We'll call it living being. Sorry. Those bodhisattvas won't see any person. So it's again, you know, we thought he was going to finally give a straight answer. And and he gave another one of those, you know, mystical answers. He said, there will be bodhisattvas, high bodhisattvas in those days. But those bodhisattvas will not see these four things. They will not see any self. They will not see any sentient beings. They will not see any life. They will not see any person. Okay. These four are all synonyms, and they have the same level of existence as the gaksha, which is what? They don't exist. Okay. Don't exist. All right. These are synonyms in Madhyamika for gaksha. These are the four things, these are four more things that we deny even exist. They are synonyms for gaksha. So is there a dude in a red suit up there talking or not? Am I a self? Am I a person or not? Do I exist or not? Here you have to get into a concept called... Did everybody get that? Oh. Can I put it down here? I think here you get into a really important question that you hear, you know. Does the self exist or not? You know, Buddhism is always talking about no self. Mm-hmm. You hear the self doesn't exist. And if you're a Westerner who's seriously trying to be a good Buddhist, it makes you sort of schizophrenic, you know. Like, am I supposed to be myself or not? You know, is it wrong to be myself? Is there something I'm missing here? You know, whose hair am I supposed to comb in the morning, you know? You know, you get a little, you get confused. I mean, they say Buddhism believes in no self. And then you're like, well, who am I then? And is it somehow wrong for me to think of myself, or what am I doing wrong? Okay. You have to distinguish between, say, yugyu dot, yugyu dot, and megyu dot. Megyu dot. Yugyu dot means the self which does exist. The self which does exist. And megyu dot means the self that don't exist. Alright? The self that doesn't exist. And there's two kinds of dots. There's two kinds of self. content. The second one is the self which doesn't exist. The first one is the self which does exist. Okay. What's the self that doesn't exist? You tell me. A self-existent self, which means a self which is not a projection onto part. Okay. So when you say no self in Buddhism, when you say the self doesn't exist, it means a self which is not a projection onto a collection of parts. Did I get that right? The self that doesn't exist is any Michael Roach that could exist without me projecting myself onto these parts. That kind of self doesn't exist. You'll never find it. That kind of self could never change. That kind of self could never reach Buddhahood. That kind of self could never get the four bodies of a Buddha. Why? There wouldn't be any blank me to project a new kind of projection onto. And that's what Buddhahood is. That's how you get to Buddhahood. If I was an independently existing, external, by myself, existing that way, inherently, independent of my projections, independent of my karmic seed, independent of any kind of emptiness, then I could never change. I would always be stuck in this body. I'd always be like that. The only way to change is if my projections shift. That's the only way I'm ever going to get to be a Buddha. It doesn't happen outside. It's a shift in projection. Okay. Michael Roach self, which is what it seems to be, you know, some kind of external, independent reality, inherent reality, could never change, could never reach Buddhahood, could never be enlightened. Michael Roach was just a projection, and if I could get those projections to shift a bit on that empty, if I could play a different movie on the empty screen, then I could reach Buddhahood. And that's it. So the self that doesn't exist is the one that I look like to you most of the time. In fact, up to about 24 hours ago. Okay? Really. That's the self that doesn't exist. The one that you thought. You know, where did you think karma was supposed to stay? And how did you think karma was going to come down on you? You know, was it there, a UFO was going to deliver the results of karma and come out and put a suit on you and suddenly you're a Buddha? You know, it doesn't work like that. You become a Buddha because your projections upon yourself shift and they're forced upon you by your past deeds. You don't have a choice at that point. Okay? Any other kind of Michael Roach is a two-headed elephant. Is a cucumber growing in midair. You know, it just doesn't exist. There's no such thing. If I were a self-existent Michael Roach, then everybody in this audience would have exactly the same reaction to me. You know, if being boring, medium, or interesting, if any of those three were my quality, if they belonged to me, everybody would be bored. Maybe they are, but that's it. No, okay? If it was a quality inherent in me, everybody would be having the same reaction to me. It ain't. It's not a quality in me. It's a quality of your own projections, obviously. Okay? So what's the self that doesn't exist? It's one that's externally, it exists out there on its own, and the qualities that you see are qualities of me and not things that you're projecting onto me. Are the projections voluntary? Absolutely not. I mean, when I say projection, I never want you to think, oh, hey, let's just change the projection. Let's make him interesting for like, I got 20 more minutes, I got to stay here. Let's project him as interesting, you know. You can't do it. Okay, it doesn't work that way. Projections are forced on you. Okay. Any other kind of self doesn't exist. Okay. Any other kind of Michael Roach doesn't exist. A Michael Roach who is self-existently out there as a quality of him, interesting or medium or not or boring, doesn't exist. That doesn't exist. It never did exist. But our minds are always interpreting it that way. We believe that all these things are external to us. We believe that they have their own reality external to us. We believe all the qualities we see in them are qualities that belong to them and not to our minds. And we act on that. And that makes us act ignorantly. You try to manipulate reality rather than changing your own goodness. You try to manipulate the world around you with your arms and fingers rather than changing your karma. Changing your karma is the only way to get what you want. The other things don't work. You've tried it. It just don't work. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's not a cause. Okay. So that you have to distinguish between the two selves. What's the self that does exist? Yeah. I am, there is a, there are four limbs and a round head up here connected to a torso. And you are seeing something going on, and that's all sense data being glued together in your mind, and your mind imputing it, nice talk, bad talk, not interesting, interesting. But that's your mind. That self that you produce that well, it's called Sakpechu. The production of that process, the thing that you came out with at the end, is the existent self. That exists. That's up there talking. That's up there being boring, interesting, or indifferent. Okay? That self exists. I'll say it again. The self that is a result or a production of your projections onto certain data, and you coming out with this guy standing up there and teaching you something, that self exists. I mean, obviously, because it's functioning. It's having an effect on you. If it didn't exist, it couldn't do that. So there obviously is a self that exists, and there obviously is a self that doesn't exist. If Lord Buddha says to Subhuti, those great bodhisattvas in the future are not so stupid to think a self exists, which one is he talking about? The non-existent self, okay? The Buddha is trying to tell Subhuti, okay, Subhuti, it's okay. You asked a stupid question. I cleared it up. Don't ask it again, he says. And then he says, but by the way, and he's always using things as an excuse to talk about emptiness, right? Because by the way, those bodhisattvas that do come in the future, they are not going to make the mistake that we are making here, that thinking that this self exists independent of my projections. They will not see such a self. They will not see such a semchen. Semchen means living being. They will not see such a sok. Sok means life. They will not see such a gansa. Gansa means person. Okay. Taken independently, these four things are equivalent to the gacha. If you take them as existing independently, inherently, self-existent four things, they don't exist. But each one has a brother, which is what? The one that does exist, just because it's a product of your projections. Okay. So each one has two parts. There's two versions of each. Why does the Buddha mention four different things? Why does he just say they won't believe in a self-existent self? Why does he go through mentioning four? Kamalashila gives a really beautiful answer. And I thought we'll close it with that. That'll be the last thing today. He says, Dak refers to the self that you hold on to when you think you yourself are self-existent. Okay? That's the object that you're holding on to when you think you yourself exist outside of your projections. Does that exist? No. Okay? It's you thinking that you are self-existent. It's the object of your thoughts when you say, Michael is self-existent. Ellie is self-existent. Okay. That's the object of your idea right then. It's a non-existent me. And for each person, it's different. It's the me. It's your me. Okay. Can you have a sense of your own me? Are you a me? Of course you are. You're a projected, artificial me. Okay. Are you an independent me, external of your own projections? Would you be a me the way you are now without your own karmic seeds ripening and forcing you to see certain kind of me? No, not at all. There's no such me like that. So the first time when the Buddha says they don't see any dak or they don't see any self, he's referring to me, the false me, the me that don't exist. Okay. That has a special name in Buddhist philosophy. It's called Jigso La Tawa. Say Jigso La Tawa. Jigso La Tawa. This is the particular kind of ignorance that makes you suffer. The first link of the 12 links is Jigso La Tawa. It's not just a general thinking that this tree is self-existent, or this stupa is self-existent, or this platform is self-existent. It's specifically the ignorance which holds you yourself to be self-existent. Why is that so deadly? Mm-hmm. then you can have mental afflictions. When someone hurts the self-existent me, I get mad. When someone helps the self-existent me, I'm happy. And in one case I respond with anger, and the other case I respond with attachment. Okay. And it gets me in trouble. That particular form of ignorance, grasping to the self of Mike, you grasping to the self of each of you, that's the one that's giving you trouble. That's the one that's causing all your suffering. That specific one, it's so specific that it has a separate name called Jigsaw Lata. And that is the first link of dependent origination. Holding on to that particular self is the first link. Say Semtien?
Semtien.
If you're trying to learn Tibetan, I'll explain this word a little bit, because Drakpa Shedup gives a good explanation. Generally speaking, in Buddhist philosophy, we distinguish between Buddhas and non-Buddhas. Buddhas and non-Buddhas. Non-Buddhas, we call Semtien. These are living beings, but if you're going to be more precise, living beings who are not yet Buddhas. Sem means mind. Chen means possesses. Does the Buddha possess a mind? Of course, he has body number 4. So technically speaking, a Buddha is a Semtien. But in Buddhist philosophy, we don't use this word for Buddha. Okay? It's used for all other... When you say, I'm going to save all sentient beings, you're referring to all other... This is the word that they're translating. A living being. Is the Buddha alive? Of course. Is the Buddha sentient? Of course. Is he a Semtien, sentient being? No. It's a huge debate in the monastery. Okay? This is the first time I've ever seen in Buddhist scripture a good explanation of this word. Chöne Drakpa Shedup says, a mind haver is called a mind haver because they have a mind which is tortured by samsara. Who's that leave out? I mean, it leaves out Buddhas automatically. So that's a beautiful explanation. You know, Sem means mind, and Chen means haver. So Semtien, or the word sentient being, is always referring in Buddhist philosophy to a being whose mind is still tormented by samsara. I was afraid you asked me that. It's a pamshe. Pamshe means general explanation, and please don't ask for any detail. Technically speaking, an arhat has overcome samsara. Technically speaking, he still has suffering. Okay, his body is still getting old and wrinkled and bald and everything else. Okay, that's a very difficult point. I won't get into it. Kamala Shila says the reason the Buddha mentioned number 2 here is to refer to that specific kind of grasping to self-existence which focuses on something that is yours, mine, as opposed to me. Okay. Number 2, the reason why the Buddha said those big bodhisattvas won't grasp to sentient beings is that they will not grasp to mine. Okay. Ngadangaya Dzimbe Lo. The full form of the first link of dependent origination, the blind man, ignorance, is actually focused at these two, me and mine. Okay. When you perceive emptiness directly for the first time, the emptiness that you perceive is yours. It's the one that belongs to you. It's in my case, the emptiness of might. And when you come out, one of the many realizations you have, and we'll talk about those realizations, is when I get to be a Buddha, they won't call me Mike anymore. Okay? Seriously, it's one of the realizations you have. Meaning, I won't exist in the way that I grasped myself in the past. Mm-hmm. Self-existent me, self-existent mine. Okay? So, Dak Self means self-existent me for each person. Semtien or sentient being in this scripture means self-existent mine. My leg, my arm, my head, my life, my mind. Okay? What does Sok refer to? Why does the Buddha say those big bodhisattvas in the tenth of the 500 year period won't grasp to a life? Kamala Shila says this refers to grasping to yourself as self-existent over the course of a whole lifetime. Okay? It's grasping to yourself as self-existent.